of the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, March 26, 2024, right here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I'm your reader, Mary Francis, and let's take a look at the front page of the Gazette. There's a large photograph of a woman, and the caption reads, Kay Ingersoll stands with some of the work she did during her time as director of the Kinney Pioneer Museum, Assembling the History of North Iowa. And the headline is, Too Many Stories Not to Tell, the Kinney Pioneer Museum. And the second story is, Spark of Inspiration, McNider Displays Local Students' Work. So we'll start off with the big story, with the photo. This is from Jacob Schaefer of the Globe Gazette. Museum Director Kay Ingersoll retiring April 15. When a friend from church asked Kay Ingersoll in 2006 if she wanted some cleaning work, Ingersoll considered it, like other part-time cleaning gigs she's picked up previously, a few hours a week, good money in exchange for tidying up a house. But things changed when Ingersoll pulled up to the address her friend had given her and found her feet at the entrance of the Kinney Pioneer Museum, nestled next to the airport, between Mason City and Clear Lake. After meeting the museum board and walking out with the job, Ingersoll's life changed. She took on the task of assistant director of the museum, becoming director in 2013, sparking a love for history, storytelling, and challenges Ingersoll tested every day. She dedicated 18 years to not only cleaning the museum, but also revamping exhibits, envisioning new layouts, and digging up so much history her fingers are figuratively covered in dirt. Ingersoll said she never imagined she would be the director. I started with no knowledge. I didn't care about the history of anything, let alone Mason City or North Iowa, Ingersoll said. But once I got here, and I was working, I realized there's too many stories not to tell. After years of working on displays, chasing down local history, and making visitors' eyes widen in wonder, Ingersoll has announced her retirement. From the beginning, Ingersoll knew her strength, ambition. That translated to having a vision for the museum, its exhibits, layout, even its color of paint, and working hard each day to make a little more progress. I just had a focus, she said. How do you eat an elephant? It's one bite at a time. Ingersoll wasn't alone in her endeavors, and she admits the museum's success doesn't come from her alone, but from the team of volunteers, historians, and workers around her, like Mason City Police Sergeant Greg Scott. Scott is a local historian with a focus on Mason City fire and police history and has worked with Ingersoll for years, saying she's passionate and will be missed at the museum. She's a good steward of Cerro Gordo history, Scott said. It's going to be hard to fill her shoes. I don't know if there's someone so knowledgeable and bubbly who enjoys talking about history like she does. Scott said for the last 4 years he's helped Ingersoll, getting calls about a new piece in an exhibit, answering police history questions, and working at the museum. God bless her. I wish her goodwill in her retirement, Scott said. I think Kay took a lot of pride in her work. She's always cleaning. She always has new ideas. Ingersoll said she can tell what a visitor is particularly excited to see, whether it's the Pioneer Cabin, Dillinger's bank robbery display, or the vintage cars. She loves watching their eyes light up as she gives her tours. I love giving tours, I really do, because the passion is here, and the more I dig, the more I find out about things I can share, she said. When I give tours, people always say this must be my passion, and I agree. The museum doesn't just take visitors back in time, but to numerous instances in time with each exhibit, and with many exhibits like a vintage sweet shop, pioneer-era workspace, an old Mason City fire truck, in nearly every decade of North Iowa history accounted for, the museum is littered with artifacts documenting the area. Additionally, Ingersoll said she was blessed with amazing support during her time as director, namely from her late husband, Bob. He gave me the strength to keep going, she said. I could not have done it without him. He was my biggest cheerleader. Until her last day at the museum, which will be April 15, Ingersoll said she's working to make the transition for the next director, Faith Lawler, as smooth as possible, hoping Lawler can pick up where Ingersoll left off. "I just want the museum to be in a good place for the next director before I go," she said. "I don't think I'll be emotional until I finally leave." From painting the space, believing in her vision, and becoming an ambassador for North Iowa history, Ingersoll said she hopes her tenure at the museum has preserved the history of where she's from. "Every single thing in here has a story to tell," she said. Next story from the front page. Spark of inspiration. McNider displays local students' work. 57 pieces from North Iowa showcased for school art show. And then it shows a photo of a young lady, Wilmarie Burgos-Quiles, posing with her artwork titled Untitled, a chalk pastel. She's a sixth grader at Forest Middle School. Artworks by some of North Iowa's most talented students are on display at McNider Art Museum's 40th annual school art show, and the theme is Spark the Art. Through April 13th, there are 57 pieces on display at the museum to celebrate Youth Art Month. Students from Belmont Clemmie Junior High School, Forest City Middle School, Hampton Dumont CAL Community Schools, Homeschool Group, John Adams Middle School, and Lincoln Intermediate in Mason City and West Hancock Middle School submitted artworks. A total of 171 entries were judged. 57 are on display. Each year, the exhibit features creations by different age groups, with elementary, middle, or high school student works exhibited. Wilmarie is excited to have her chalk pastel drawing featured in the show. The piece prominently shows a moose wrapped in evening colors. "Kinds of art too," she said. There are two- and three-dimensional artworks on display. One table is filled with barn quilts, finished in a joint project between the industrial and fine arts classes at Mason City's Lincoln Intermediate School. Display cases hold sculptures of varying sizes. An awards ceremony was held at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, with art teachers handing out certificates to each student who attended. McNider Art Museum is free. Free admission and open to the public from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., Tuesdays and Thursdays, 9 to 5 on Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, and it is closed on Sunday and Monday. It's located at 303 2nd Street Southeast in Mason City. And you can call if you have any questions, and the phone number there is 641-421-3666. And then it shows multiple photographs of the artwork on display. 43 North Iowa launches $2.2 million campaign lead gift. The Board of Directors of 43 North Iowa is unveiling its $2.2 million innovation campaign, according to a press release. Board Chairperson Ed Weininger said, "Over the past year, 43 North Iowa has been working in a quiet phase, raising funds to expand or start several programs. We're grateful for the support we have received today. Our final project is the Innovation Campaign to renovate the former Globe Gazette building for services." Executive Director John Derryberry announced the organization has received a $100,000 lead gift to kick off the campaign. A heartfelt thank you goes to honorary co-chairs Steve and Patty Weiss, longtime supporters of 43 North Iowa, for the significant gift, said Derryberry. "This generous contribution is a major step toward achieving our goal. It is their hope and ours that this donation inspires others to give." 43 North Iowa signed a groundbreaking contract 1 year ago for a $2.7 million grant from the Iowa Nonprofit Innovation Fund to fuel expansions for mental health services in North Iowa. The funding for the last of the expansions is 60% complete. Several programs have been developed, including Crisis Residential Services. This program provides 5 beds and offers an essential alternative to emergency room visits or inpatient psychiatric stays. It can divert individuals from law enforcement when mental health is the primary concern. The Crisis Residential Services home is set to open in May. An open house is slated for April 12th. Funding for the project came through Central Iowa Community Services. The focus is now on the expansion and relocation of the residential care facility for persons with mental illness. Currently facing a waiting list of up to 101 days, the the RCF-PMI will move to the former Globe Gazette building, which is located at 300 North Washington Avenue in Mason City, where it will be transformed into the Transitional Living Center, the release said. The building will accommodate 15 beds, provide employment services, therapy spaces, family rooms, and increase community engagement. The organization is now expanding its efforts to the community for support. Quote, "We invite everyone who cares about community mental health to join us on this journey. Let us make North Iowa safer and more inclusive for our most vulnerable neighbors," said Derryberry. You can contact Derryberry at this phone number, 641-424-8708. And then there's a photo that's the interior of the former Globe Gazette building, showing people standing there amidst the renovation stuff. And now news in brief. Charges pending after single car rollover in Cerro Gordo County. A single vehicle crash in Plymouth Friday night led to the driver receiving serious injuries. The Cerro Gordo County Sheriff's Office received the call just before 10:30 p.m., March 22nd, for a rollover near the intersection of 330th Street and College Drive in Plymouth. Deputies identified 33-year-old Jeremy Hummel of Nora Springs as the driver of a Chevy Equinox, which had flipped when Hummel apparently failed to navigate a curve, rolling several times. According to the police report, Hummel was not wearing a seatbelt. Officers alleged that alcohol and the use of an electronic device were contributing factors to the crash. Hummel was transported by ambulance to Mercy One Medical Center, North Iowa, with serious injuries. Charges are pending following the completion of the investigation. Our next brief, icy conditions result in rollover in Cerro Gordo County. Sunday morning, icy road conditions resulted in a rollover in Cerro Gordo County. The Cerro County Sheriff's Office received a call for a crash just past 8:30 a.m. on March 24 on Thrush Avenue in the area of 290th Street. Law enforcement said Frederick Giles, age 71, of Osage, was driving south on Thrust Avenue when he lost control of his 2001 Chevy Tahoe because of the snow and ice and entered the road's west ditch. After entering the ditch, the Tahoe rolled and landed back on its wheels. Also in the vehicle was 70-year-old Ruby Giles, also from Osage. Frederick and Ruby told emergency responders of minor pain and they were taken to Mercy Hospital to be checked out. In addition, the county sheriff's deputies, the Plymouth Fire Department, and the Mason City Fire Medics assisted on the scene. Our next brief, Mason City offices closed for Good Friday, yard waste pickup announced. City offices will be closed Friday. City transit buses will operate on that day, the city announced in a press release. Garbage and recycling service for those that normally have pickup on this day will be collected on Wednesday. Citizens are asked to have their garbage and recyclables on the curb by 7 a.m. on the sanitation pickup day. The yard waste collection season will begin Monday. Residents can set out yard waste and tree branches on the day of garbage pickup. Several methods of disposal are available for yard waste. Leaves may be composted at home, dropped off at the North Iowa Landfill compost site located at 15942 Kildare Avenue in Clear Lake, or placed at the curbside prior to 7 a.m. on garbage collection day. Yard waste must be in 30-gallon biodegradable bags that are weather and animal resistant. Bags are available at grocery and retail stores. There's a 50-pound limit per bag of leaves and grass clippings. Branches may not be placed in biodegradable bags. Branches smaller than 4 inches in diameter may be chipped for mulch or tied in bundles. Bundles cannot be bigger than 18 inches in diameter or 4 feet long. Do not use wire. Place bundles at the street curb before 7 a.m. on garbage collection day or take them to the landfill. For more information, you can contact the Sanitation Division. Their number is 641-421-3691. And you can learn more about composting at home at the Cerro Gordo County Extension Office, and their phone number is 641-423-0844. Candidates for office have filed for election. This is from Robin McClelland of the Globe Gazette. Candidates have filed to be on the primary election ballot in Cerro Gordo County. The deadline was March 15th for candidates of all parties. Candidates for office are as follows. United States Representative District 2, incumbent Ashley Hinson, Republican, Sarah Corkery, Democrat. State Senator District 30, incumbent Waylon Brown, Republican, Richard Lawrence, Democrat, and Doug Campbell, Republican. State Representative District 59, Jeremy True, Democrat, and Christian Hermanson, Republican. State Representative District 60, incumbent Jane E. Bloomingdale, Republican, John Rosenfeld, Republican. Cerro Gordo County Supervisor, District 1, incumbent Chris Watts, Republican, Timothy L. LaPointe, Democrat. Cerro Gordo County Supervisor, District 3, incumbent Lori Meacham Ganap, Democrat, Carl Ganap, Republican. Cerro Gordo County Auditor, incumbent Adam Wedmore, Democrat, and Cerro Gordo County Sheriff, Brian Koob, Democrat, Matt Clunder, Republican, David Hepperly, Republican. And then it shows headshots of each of the candidates who filed. Fired corrections officer sues state for defamation. This is from Clark Kaufman. A former corrections officer is suing the state for allegedly firing him after he was wrongfully accused of sexual relations with an inmate. Jared Eugene Dyers of Mahaska County is suing the Ottumwa Residential Correctional Facility, that's a state-run work treatment facility, its manager, Ted Robinson, the Dan Fell, the director of the 8th District of the Iowa Department of Corrections, and corrections employees Lisa Hoke and Nicole Harbison. The lawsuit, which was moved recently from state court to federal court, seeks unspecified damages for defamation, denial of due process, and interference with a contractual relationship. According to the lawsuit, Dyers worked at the Ottumwa Residential Correctional Facility as a residential officer from April 2023 until June 2023 when he was fired. Within a few weeks of being hired, Dyers claims, he learned that a rumor was circulating at work that he had been sexually intimate with a male inmate. A co-worker allegedly showed Dyers an image the co-worker had created using photo editing software to depict Dyers in a tuxedo standing next to a male inmate in a wedding dress. The co-worker allegedly stated that Hoke had started and was spreading a rumor about Dyers and the inmate. Subsequently, multiple corrections employees asked Dyers about the rumor, as did two inmates. One of those inmates allegedly told Dyers they knew Hoke was spreading the rumor. In late May, the corrections facility launched an investigation of Dyers, at which point two inmates allegedly offered to make statements on Dyers' behalf. According to the lawsuit, Dyers told the inmates if they wanted to provide statements, he would submit them on their behalf. According to the lawsuit, the facility later alleged that by answering the inmates' questions about submitting statements, Dyers had impeded the investigation. On May 30, he was suspended without pay, and 1 month later he was fired. The lawsuit alleges corrections officials never investigated Hoke's reported role in the matter. The defendants have yet to file a response to the lawsuit. Next story. Mobile Workforce Center heading to Perry where pork plant is closing. This is from the Globe Gazette Des Moines Bureau. A recently created state mobile workforce center will be deployed to Perry to assist workers who are about to be impacted by the closure of a food processing plant there, the state announced on Friday. Tyson Foods, earlier this month, announced that it is closing a pork plant in Perry that employs 1,200 people, eliminating the largest employer in the central Iowa community. Iowa Workforce Development will send its Iowa Works Mobile Workforce Center, which is a 32-foot custom-built bus, to Perry on Monday and Tuesday, so yesterday and today. Career planners with the State Workforce Agency will be there to answer questions and prepare workers for navigating the unemployment process, including looking for new jobs, the state agency said. The Mobile Workforce Center was built to supplement the state's 18 Iowa Works offices to deliver workforce services to Iowans who may not have easy access to those offices. It was unveiled during a news conference last month. The state workforce agency has been working with Tyson Foods and Perry community leaders since the plant closure and pending layoffs were announced. Responding to evolving situations like these is exactly the reason why we've deployed the Mobile Workforce Center to reach workers more quickly and directly, said Iowa Workforce Development Executive Director Beth Townsend in a news release. It continues, "While this is just the initial phase of services for this June layoff, we are committed to supporting every impacted worker through the process to ultimately help them find a new career in the state. It's important that we not only provide wide-ranging support in these situations, but also take the time to identify the specific needs of the impacted workers in Perry," unquote. Information about the Mobile Workforce Center and a list of rapid response services for Iowa workers facing layoffs can be found on the Iowa Workforce Development website. Iowa's unemployment rate decreased by 1/10 of a percentage point to 2.9% in February, according to the State Workforce Department. The 2.9% rate equals the February 2023 jobless rate. The national unemployment rate in February was 3.9%. February was warmer than normal, and the impact of that showed up in Iowa's economy, said Iowa Workforce Development Executive Director Beth Townsend in a news release. Iowa businesses added jobs in nearly every major industry last month, from construction and manufacturing to healthcare and accommodation and food services. At the same time, we also saw a slight decline in the overall workforce, with most who left saying they were doing so to attend classes. Iowa Republican Attorney General Brenna Byrd will lead a lawsuit against Democrat President Joe Biden's administration over a greenhouse gas emission policy, Byrd's office said. The lawsuit challenges a federal requirement that businesses disclose their greenhouse gas emissions and climate-related risks, and adopt and release a plan to adapt to climate policy recommendations. Quote, "Biden's radical climate mandate is the most outrageous act of overreach we've seen from the Securities and Exchange Commission since Biden took office. The SEC is supposed to prevent people from getting ripped off, not force an illegal climate mandate that is far outside of their wheelhouse," Byrd said in a news release. The news release continues, "Biden's climate mandate will only saddle businesses with costly red tape, threaten our supply chain, and devastate Iowa family farms. Now we're going to teach Biden that not even he is above the law," unquote. Byrd, along with 19 other state leaders, signed on to a legal brief on a case in a federal appeals court regarding military reservist pay. The letter urges the U.S. Supreme Court to make sure that federal employees who serve in the military reserves do not lose their pay when deployed, according to the Iowa AG's office. Quote, "Our military heroes should never face a pay cut for serving our country," Byrd said in a news release. "The least we can do is ensure that those who risk their lives for our safety get the pay that they deserve. I'm calling on the U.S. Supreme Court to uphold the law and protect the pay of our military heroes," unquote. And we have one obituary today. Mark Edward Volk, that's V-O-L-K, born February 23rd, 1955 in Des Moines. He entered into eternal rest March 22 at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center after a hard-fought year-long battle with pancreatic cancer. Funeral service, April 1st, 10 a.m. at the St. James Lutheran Church, located at 1148 4th Street in Mason City. Burial will take place at Riverside Cemetery in Rockford, Iowa. Visitation will be held at the church the night prior from 4 to 6 p.m. Memorials may be directed to the family. Says Mark was a lifelong Iowa boy, spent his years on a dairy farm in West Des Moines, where he attended Sacred Heart Elementary. Later moved to Pleasantville, where he enjoyed growing up on a farm with his siblings. Graduated Pleasantville High School, class of 1973. He studied agriculture and animal science at Iowa State. Loyal, forever true, he graduated in 1977. It was here that he met his lifelong love and best friend, Bee. They married August 28, 1976, at Zion Lutheran Church. Mark and Bee moved to Rockford in 1978. Here they raised their three daughters. Mark worked at the family-owned farms for over 30 years. When the daughters graduated from high school, Mark and Bee moved to Mason City. He truly enjoyed his profession as an auditor for agricultural business for the remainder of his life. He traveled across the country and working with animals. He enjoyed fishing, horses, landscaping, and watching the cyclones. His greatest accomplishment and deepest love with his family. Preceding him in death are his parents, Ed and Jean, parents-in-law Harold and Frances Tretton, both his maternal and paternal grandparents. Opinion page from the Globe Gazette. The political cartoon just shows one figure. It's the Monopoly guy, the rich guy from Monopoly, standing there against a field of green. He's leaning on his rich guy cane. He's wearing a tuxedo. He's lifting his top hat. And his head is not a human head. It is the Apple computer logo. This opinion comes from Megan McArdle of the Washington Post, and she writes, "We'll soon find out the true value of real estate agents. How much do you value the services of a real estate agent? This might be a question you've never bothered to ask. According to the National Association of Realtors, about 90% of buyers and sellers used an agent last year, and mostly that decision was probably automatic. Sellers needed them to get their homes on the multiple listing service, that's the MLS, which is a database of properties for sale that brokerages operate jointly. And buyers, well, maybe they haven't needed agents in these days of Zillow and Redfin, but why not use them? After all, it costs them nothing because the seller pays the fee. But this arrangement has long been riddled with conflicts of interest and opportunities for collusion, which is one reason Americans have been paying some of the highest real estate commissions in the world, typically about 6%, split between the buyers and sellers' agents. Eventually, this invited lawsuits, and last year, a Missouri jury thwacked the National Association of Realtors with a $1.8 billion verdict. Last week, apparently fearing more and worse to come, NAR announced a $418 million settlement that theoretically could radically change the way this market operates by making it easier for sellers to negotiate fees and forcing buyers' agents to work for their own clients rather than for the sellers. I say theoretically because, though for decades regulators and courts have been cracking down on too cozy arrangements between real estate agents, the agents, with the enterprising spirit for which American business is so justly famed, kept finding new ways to maintain high fees. This could happen again. Yet the changes are substantial enough that it seems possible that this settlement will fundamentally alter how things are done. In which case, Americans will have to ask themselves something they should have asked decades ago. How much is a real estate agent worth to you? The answer, I'm confident, will be less than 6%. Arguably, the value of brokerage services has been dropping since the NAR was founded in 1908. Just imagine how hard it would have been to buy or sell a house without an agent when buyers and sellers had no easy way to know which properties were available, which neighborhoods might be appealing, how much houses usually sold for, or whether a place you saw advertised was something you'd actually be interested in. Since then, the MLS has made the market more transparent and efficient, and agents deserve credit for creating it. But the advent of automobiles made it easier for buyers to zip from open house to open house, and photographs enable them to rule out properties before visiting them, without needing an agent to help narrow their choices. And now the internet has changed the game entirely. Today, home buyers go online to see detailed photos, virtual tours, and every home's past sales history. The internet also instantly delivers other data that brokers might once have offered. Neighborhood crime rates, schools, problem residents, coming local developments, and what nearby houses have sold for. This is not to say buyer's agents are useless. They can let buyers into houses, help them fill out paperwork, make sure the termite inspection happens, and hold people's hands through the biggest transaction of their lives. But if I imagine how much I'd personally be willing to pay for these services, it's somewhere between $500 and $2,000. Today, an agent who finds a buyer of a $500,000 home typically collects many times that amount. Seller's agents potentially add much more value than that through expert staging, price setting, marketing, and negotiation. But that potential is not always realized. Many sellers find their brokers by getting recommendations from friends, which probably selects for amiability rather than skill. Researchers suggest that brokers often underprice homes, either by mistake or because it's in their interest to sell houses quickly and move on to the next deal instead of waiting for top dollar. When real estate agents sell their own homes, they take a few more days to sell, but for 3.7% more. A 2005 study from economists Stephen Levitt and Chad Siverson found, according to a study from 2012, which looked at a market where the listing service was unbundled from other services such as marketing and negotiation, and many sellers didn't use agents. Adding a broker to the transaction reduced the selling price by 5.9 to 7.7%. That suggests that even without the value of MLS access, those brokers were worse than useless. It's also undoubtedly true that this service could be provided for considerably less than 6% of the sale price of your home. And that was from Megan McArdle, who writes for the Washington Post. And that brings us to the halfway point of today's reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, March 26, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Now we'll take a look at the Fort Dodge Messenger. Our biggest story, Fulfilling a Dream. Mirnka wraps up 36 years with Fort Dodge Police Department. Other stories, developer says more coming to Corridor Plaza. Getting away at Sportsman Retreat. And East Sac County Playground Project timeline is set. So we'll start with the big story, Fort Dodge City Council. It shows a bunch of police officers in a full city council room, all smiling as Police Chief Dennis Quinn talks about his 36-year career in the police department. This is from Bill Shea. Dennis Mirnka knew he wanted to be a police officer ever since he was a little boy. So in 1987, he pinned on a Fort Dodge Police Department badge for the first time. Thursday, after 36 years of protecting and serving the community, Mirnka will retire with the rank of lieutenant. I fulfilled my dream, he said Monday evening during the Fort Dodge City Council meeting. Police Chief Dennis Quinn said 36 years is a long time for a person to be in any job. During his long tenure, Mirnka arrested a lot of criminals, Quinn said. But more importantly, he helped a lot of people, the chief added. For perhaps his most dramatic move to help someone, Mirnka received the Sullivan Brothers Award of Valor, along with two other local officers, for grabbing a man as he jumped off the Union Pacific Railroad High Bridge in an attempt to end his life. The officers were unable to hold on to the man, but because of their efforts, he only fell 40 feet and survived his injuries. Former Fort Dodge Patrol Officer Nathan Eldridge and Iowa State Patrol Trooper Matt Imers also received the Sullivan Brothers Award of Valor for that December 12, 2015 incident. That award is the highest honor presented in Iowa for saving a life. To replace Mirnka, Caitlin Carlisle was promoted from sergeant to lieutenant. She's been a city police officer since 2015. She served in both patrol and investigations. She's a member of the Special Emergency Response Team and has served as a field training officer. She has a bachelor's degree from the University of Iowa in Iowa City. Leighton Walker was promoted from patrol officer to sergeant. He's been a city police officer since 2009, and in that time, he has served as a field training officer for many new members of the force. Walker is an Army veteran who served two combat tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. Two new officers were also added to the force to fill vacancies. Jennifer Smith is a graduate of Fort Dodge Senior High School and Iowa Central Community College. Anthony Luft is a graduate of Humboldt High School and is a former Webster City police officer. And then we have, developer says more coming to Corridor Plaza. This is from Bill Shea. Two more restaurants and a national retailer could be coming to Corridor Plaza soon, a spokesman for the development group overseeing the transformation of the former Crossroads Mall site said Monday night. B.J. Stokesbury of Crossroads Plaza Development LLC of Ankeny gave the Fort Dodge City Council an indication of what could be coming next without naming any specific businesses. He said a full-service restaurant is considering a location on the north end of the site at the intersection of 1st Avenue South and 27th. A lot on the eastern side of that intersection, next to Unity Point Express Care, is being contemplated by a national retailer, he added. The lot near the busy intersection of 1st Avenue South and 29th may become the site of a national chain restaurant, he added. Hy-Vee Fast and Fresh is the one potential occupant of Corridor Plaza that Stokesbury did name. He said a lot on the 29th Street side of the site was sold to Hy-Vee last year for the construction of one of its Fast and Fresh convenience stores. He said Crossroads Plaza Development has the right to buy the lot back if it's not developed. He said a decision by Hy-Vee is expected by May. In addition to Unity Point Express Care, Corridor Plaza is already home to Discount Tire, Teriyaki Madness, Clean Laundry, T-Mobile, and Tidal Wave Spa. The developers announced that Dunham's Sporting Goods, Maurice's, and Shoe Sensation will be opening this fall in the former Yonkers wing of the mall, which is the only portion of the mall that is still standing. A sports pavilion is planned for the west side of the site. The 200 by 250 foot facility will house four basketball courts, three pickleball courts, and a microbrewery. On Monday, the City Council unanimously approved a development agreement with M&M LLC of Ankeny, which will build and own the sports pavilion. The pavilion is set to be done by the end of this year. Under the terms of the agreement, the city will pay the developer $2.65 million, with that money coming from a future bond issue. The city government will also make five annual payments of $275,000 each annually to the developer. All of those figures were discussed previously by the council. The development agreement approved Monday puts those in writing formally. Our next story, getting away at Sportsman's Retreat. And it shows a photograph of Andy Jansen and three of his sons, or a couple of his sons and one of their friends, standing there with fishing poles. This is from Lori Berglund. More than 600 fathers and sons, brothers and grandfathers, and lots of old friends gathered at the annual Sportsman's Retreat at Hidden Acres near Dayton this weekend. This men's only retreat has become a popular event and draws men and boys from across the nation, according to Ryan Graydon, Ministries Director at Hidden Acres. Now in its 34th year, the Sportsman's Retreat drew men from several states throughout the Midwest and nation. Hidden Acres describes itself as, quote, a place set apart for you, and that's just what it was for the men and boys participating this year. In the lush surroundings of this unique camp, men were invited to spend time together fishing, shooting, relaxing, and talking about God in their lives. Our goal is for ministerial purposes. Being outside in the work of creation with ample woods and recreation just seems conducive to that conversation. The weekend featured pastoral speakers, small groups, a buy and sell and trade event, and lots of time to bond outside, even despite the sometimes inclement weather. Saturday saw many groups fishing in the open water, enjoying time outside. Why is it men only? The answer might be found in a verse from Proverbs included with the brochure for the event. Quote, "As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another," unquote. Ben Fisher came from Ashland, Nebraska, with his 13-year-old son, Tage. It was Tage's first time at the camp, but it was clearly already a new favorite. He was most excited simply to be spending time alone with his dad. "We get to spend the whole weekend together," Tage said, a smile brimming from ear to ear. The father and son duo was hoping to catch a few trout in the pond, perhaps shoot a little archery, and simply relax. "There's lots of good food here," dad and son agreed. Andy Jansen came from Cedar Rapids with two sons and a friend. Born and raised in Germany, Jansen came to the United States for college in Indiana, now lives in Iowa, where he owns a CrossFit gym. He was back as a repeat visitor at the Sportsman's Retreat. "I like to come and spend time with the boys," he said. "We enjoy the sessions and talking about Christ with my boys. It also works out nice being outdoors." Alexander, age 8, was excited to be visiting the camp for the first time. His older brother, Karsten, age 11, was happy to show him the ropes of archery and other sporting attractions available at Hidden Acres. Family friend Kepler Nelson, also 11, said he looked forward to learning about all the different outdoor sports. While the Sportsman's Retreat may be men only, there are ample opportunities for the entire family all year long. "We host about 25,000 guests every year," Graydon said. "A few of the upcoming camps will be for moms and kids, dads and kids, seniors 50 and over, and many more. To learn more about the different camps and other activities, you can visit their website, which is hacamps.org. East Sac County Playground Project timeline is set. Community comes together to renovate playground. This is by Doug Klogue. East Sac County Elementary School's playground is getting a much-needed reboot for the district's preschool through sixth grade students. Quote, "It's been over 30 years since the playground has been renovated," said Julie Clayton, who was a member of the Playground Expansion Committee. "At last year's track and field day, I noticed a young student in a wheelchair who couldn't participate. I was told that she could only have the opportunity to throw a ball back and forth. That was it. I have a soft spot for children with disabilities." Clayton's children, one in fifth grade and the other in sixth, had asked their mother if they could take a basketball to school. "I told my kids that the school should have playground equipment there," said Clayton, who lives in rural Auburn. "When I was at the playground, I found all the elementary basketballs were balled, and most could not hold air. It was in bad shape for all students." With a change in Sac County Administrative Guard in 2023, Clayton saw a chance to change not only the playground for better play, but also for the better behavior of the kids. "Our test scores were not good, and our behaviors were awful," said Clayton. "I think half the behavior issues stemmed from the playground environment. The students had nothing to do, so they'd fight, and they'd take the fight into the classroom." Clayton asked for permission to write grants for new equipment. Her original proposal was for $47,000 for new balls and other equipment that would engage all students. She found that students were eager for improvements that didn't cost a lot of money, but rather time from volunteers. "The students told me that the old school at Wall Lake, they had foursquare and hopscotch, which they loved," she said. Fourth grade teacher Dallas Pullen, art teacher Lynn Wilson, and teaching assistant Lisa Gullett joined Clayton during the heat of the summer to paint foursquare, hopscotch, and tic-tac-toe grids. Marie and Mike Buse, parents of children in the district, also helped by refurbishing some old soccer goals and delivered them to the playground for the children to use. In addition, the Sac Community Recreation Center hosted a ball drive to quickly improve the fundamental pieces of the playground's success. "We wanted every kind of ball, kickballs, footballs, soccer balls, any kind of ball. The elementary ended up with 50 balls just from this drive, The kids were just ecstatic that they could play foursquare and have balls that actually held air. With good movement towards solving the problem, Clayton used that energy to begin writing grants with district-provided information on demographics. Between grants and donations, we received right around $100,000, said Clayton. Superintendent Haymiller said that the best decision would be to replace the entire playground and start over. An estimate to renovate the playground so it would be all-inclusive came in at $475,000. We went from $47,000 for new equipment to a $475,000 playground that would make a real difference for our district students. Funding is coming from a combination of school resources allocated to the project, donations from private individuals, companies, and grants. There's also a local company offering in-kind labor for dirt work prep to help keep project costs within budget. This playground is designed for children aged 5 to 12. Cunningham Recreation of Ankeny is the playground equipment supplier working on the project. The equipment will include a telescope, zip track with zip seat, wrinkle wall, swings with zero-G seats, swings with seat belts, a seesaw, an inclusive whirl, a tire swing, a set of soccer goals, and a football game made of poly by Lindahl Plastics of Odebolt and Evapco of Lakeview. Clayton owns Lakeview Family Chiropractic, and her husband Darren and she have two daughters who currently attend ESC Elementary. I've enjoyed all the relationships built during this project and realize that there are so many people who want to help find a solution leading to what's best for our students, said Clayton. The positive feedback from the administration, teachers, school personnel, community members, and children have made this project amazing. The playground project timeline includes delivery of equipment in May, with the site preparation planned for June. In August, the new inclusive playground is scheduled to be ready for students to use at the beginning of the school year, with the final completion date set for September. And then it shows photos of some of the equipment that will be installed at the new playground. Story: Intersection to get upgrade. Contract for Kenyon Roadwork awarded on a 6-1 vote on Monday. The busy intersection of Kenyon Road and Avenue C will get an overhaul this summer, while the nearby Kenyon Road Bridge is also the site of a major project. Kenyon Road on the west side of the intersection will be widened and reconfigured to create a center lane to accommodate vehicles turning left. New traffic signals will be installed, and the nearby sidewalk that is part of the community's trail system will be reconstructed. Castor Construction of Fort Dodge was hired by the City Council Monday to do the work at a cost of $1,291,770.69. The project is to be completed by this fall. At the same time, the reconstruction of the westbound lanes of the Kenyon Road Bridge are to be completed. The contract was awarded on a 6-1 vote, with Councilman Dave Flattery casting the lone no vote. "I just don't think this should be so high on the priority list," he said. He said the roughly $1.3 million to be spent on the project could be better used elsewhere. He suggested using it on downtown streets, which he said are crumbling. Other bidders for the job were Doyle Construction of Fort Dodge and Wicks Construction of Decorah. The council awarded two other infrastructure project contracts Monday by unanimous votes. Doyle Construction was hired to rebuild the parking lot behind the municipal building at First Avenue. The cost there, $256,833. The work will include removing and replacing the pavement, construction of a bioswale on the south side to hold stormwater, and the installation of storm sewers. Other bidders for the job were Jensen Builders of Fort Dodge, Castor Construction, Absolute Group of Granger, and King Knudsen of Iowa Falls. Doyle Construction was also hired to create a storage lot next to the Fort Dodge Fiber Building at 204 South 8th Street. For that, the company will be paid $98,751. Other bidders for that job were Castor Construction, Jensen Builders, TK Concrete of Pella, and King Knutson Construction. Fort Dodge Council to consider permit for dog breeders. The Fort Dodge City Council will consider requiring a permit for any dog breeders as a way to tighten the leash on those who do so without little professionalism. The city already has a law requiring commercial dog breeders to get a permit. Amending that law would help to control backyard breeders, said Kayla Benson, the owner of Webster County Animal Protection. Benson's company has been doing animal control services for both Webster County and Fort Dodge for the past 2 years. She told the council that one of the problems they have encountered is backyard breeders with multiple litters of puppies and no proper veterinary care for the puppies or their mothers. For example, she said her crew rescued 17 puppies from a house on the city's south side. Another litter of puppies was found in a plastic tub by the Des Moines River, she said. Benson said enforcement of a breeding permit would, and then here's a bulleted list, ensure that the mother dog is in the care of a licensed veterinarian, provide adequate information on where the animals are believed to be housed, prevent puppies from being adopted or sold until they are at least 8 weeks old, prevent puppies from being adopted or sold until they have their vaccinations. Something like this would make a tremendous difference, Benson said. She said Fort Dodge already has a good law requiring permits for commercial breeders. She said the council could drop the word commercial from its current rule and make it apply to all breeders. She recommended a fee of $150 for a permit. The council took no action on this proposal on Monday. To today's obituaries in the Fort Dodge Messenger, Wayne C. Anderson, age 80, of Colville, passed away Saturday, March 23rd, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home in Fort Dodge. Funeral services, Thursday, March 28, St. Olaf Lutheran Church at 11 a.m. Entombment will take place at the Chapel of Peace Mausoleum in North Lawn Cemetery. There's a visitation Wednesday at the Loffersweiler Funeral Home in Fort Dodge from 4 to 8 p.m. Jeanette Marie Gertis, age 90, of Manson, passed away Sunday, March 24, at the Marion Home in Fort Dodge. Funeral services, Saturday, March 30, 10:30 a.m., at the Faith Community Church in Palmer. Burial to follow at the St. John's Lutheran Cemetery in Lizard Township. Visitation will take place prior to the service at the church from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Arrangements have been entrusted with the Larson Wishar Funeral Home. Next is Delbert L. Nelson, age 83, of Lehigh, passed away suddenly March 22nd at his home. A come-and-go celebration of life will be held from 10:30 to 12:30 on Thursday, March 28th, at the Lehigh Community Center in Lehigh. A private family graveside service will be held at a later date. It'll take place at the McGuire Bend Cemetery in rural Dayton. David A. Plants, that's P-L-A-N-T-Z, age 56, of Rolfe, passed away unexpectedly Sunday, March 24, at the Humboldt County Memorial Hospital in Humboldt. Funeral service, 10:30 Thursday, March 28th, 10:30 a.m. at the Resurrection of Our Lord Catholic Church in Pocahontas. Burial will take place at the St. Margaret's Cemetery near Rolfe. Visitation will happen Wednesday, March 27th, 4 to 6 p.m. at the church in Pocahontas. Powers Funeral Home of Rolfe is handling the arrangements. Tammy Johnson. A gathering of family and friends will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, April 1st at the historic Bruce Funeral Home. And Sharon Delp, D-E-L-P. A celebration of life will be held at a later date at the Grace of God Church. Memorials may be directed to the family, and you can do that at this website, brucesfuneralhome.com. And that's all the time we have to cover the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger today. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of folks with print disabilities. It's been my pleasure to read for you today. I'm Mary Francis. Have a great day.